Meets the Condor, a joining of Eagle Science and Technology with Condor Heart and Spirit, where each week we make known the unknown by bringing to you an interesting guest, a new experience, a different angle on life, right here on KNRY AM 1240, and we are broadcasting from the beautiful Monterey Peninsula. I'm Nancy Lorenz. Elena Young is my co-host. Dave is our engineer. Before we begin, I'd like to welcome all of our internet listeners. We do stream these programs live on the internet, and we have people listening from San Francisco to Washington State, all the way to Australia. And we'd like to welcome everyone that's here and joining us, and thank you for your interest and for your listening time and wanting to make known the unknown for yourself as well.
Little feedback devil back.
Feedback devil. It's the full moon coming, and it's pulling the feedback devil.
Uh-huh. So Derek Jensen is with us again. He's been with us before, and it's always enjoyable and never enough time. So Derek, he's on the line now, but we're going to be talking about his newest book, Almost Out, The Culture of Make-Believe. This is a trilogy. He came and spoke about a language older than words, and that is about how not to be a slave to your own past. The culture of make-believe is about how not to be a slave to the culture's past. And the book that he is writing now is about how to take away the ability of slavers to enslave. Derek is able to take on these huge topics and make it fascinating. Derek, welcome.
Well, it's great. It's great to be on here again. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Our pleasure.
So this book is not quite out yet, right? You just got your copy?
Actually, I got my copies yesterday. And so it should, and my publisher got his copies last week, so it should be available anytime, actually. Anytime within the next week or two is when it should hit the stores.
Derek's website is Derek, D-E-R-R-I-C-K, Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, .org. And you can also go to contextbooks.com and have information there on all of his books. So, Derek, where does this begin from a language older than words? Was that transition for this book?
Well, after I wrote A Language Older Than Words, I was going to write a book on, I was going to expand a section on that that's about my teaching experience. I started to write that, and it wasn't working very well. So I didn't write anything for maybe another 6 months after that. And then I was asked by my publisher to write a 10-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. But when I asked what's a hate group, the book exploded. And, you know, I mean, the 10 pages turned into, it's a huge book. The 10 pages turned into 600. Because the first thing I did is I went to a KKK website. And the website said that, well, the KKK is not a hate group, it's a love group, because they love America and they love whites. And I started thinking, okay, what this means is either the KKK is not a hate group, or you can't trust rhetoric. And if you believe that the KKK is not a hate group, then what that means is that the only things that would qualify really as a hate group are those organizations that are unsophisticated enough to mask their hatred behind, you know, some sort of other claims to virtue. And so, you know, if you can't trust the rhetoric, what can you trust? And then, of course, the next thing I thought is that if you go just by the numbers, then the largest segregationist, racist organization in the country, in the United States, is the judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation on a scale that the KKK can only dream about. I mean, one-third of African-American males in the ages of 18 and 35 in this country are under criminal justice supervision. I mean, the statistics on all that are just appalling. So I started sort of wending my way into that, and then there were some other things came up that the gold standard, I mean, whenever anybody thinks about going to prison, so I'm thinking about prison on that, and then whenever anybody thinks about going to prison, the first thing anybody thinks of for guys is, you know, they're going to get raped. I mean, it's sort of a stock joke in sitcoms, and, you know, don't drop the soap, and you're going to get in a cell with Love Star, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
But the thing that's really interesting about the rates at which men are raped in prison is that they're lower than they are for the rates at which women are raped in the culture at large.
You're saying kind of per capita, so to speak, you mean?
Yeah, the incidence rate for men in prison, according to the gold standard studies, and my students at the prison say that it's actually lower than this, but the studies suggest that it's between 12 and 20%. And the standard for at which the rate at which women are raped in the culture at large is about 25%. Another 19% have to fend off rape attempts. And but there's not the same sort of attention. I mean, there's not that same sort of attention that's paid to the women. Or another example of this is, and then I'm going to tie all this back together in a second. Another example of this is that if you look up, like, on Google or AltaVista or something, if you look up the keyword rape, the most common type of site that you find is pornography. It's not, women's, it's not crisis centers, it's not scholarly histories, it's not education, not police reports. And so I went to some of those sites, and there were, you know, thousands and thousands. We're not even talking, later on in the book I deal with sort of straightforward pornography, but there were thousands and thousands of pictures of just really, really violent pornography. And, you know, women tied up, and it says, you know, make these young sluts do whatever you want, or something like that.
And by the way, just to interject, you didn't have to pay to see any of this anything, right? I mean, this is available to anyone of any age that's looking on the Internet.
Right, right, right. And the real point that I was, the thing that occurred to me immediately is if you had some site that had hundreds of pictures of white businessmen tied up and bound and gagged, you know, the hate watch, or of black males bound and gagged, you'd have the hate watch organizations would be all over this in a second. It would be front page news. And so what I realized really quickly is that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hate. It feels like tradition or economics or religion or just the way things are.
That is so important, Derek. That is such an accurate statement in how we come about to accept things like this.
Yeah, it's what we've come to expect. So the book really exploded at that point, and you can interrupt me with questions any time, otherwise I'll just ramble. The book really exploded at that point, and so I went to do an examination of the rationale for slavery in the pre-Civil War days. And it ends up that, because I was thinking, if you're going to find something that's filled with hate, that's going to be it. But all of their rationale were, their rationales, I mean, none of them were hateful at all. It was just religious. For example, if it was acceptable for the people in the Bible, it's acceptable for me. You know, God clearly said it was okay in the Bible. And Jesus didn't say it was bad. And in fact, Peter and Paul were very, very strongly pro-slavery. And they made a very strong case. Then there was the scientific approach that, well, you can tell by looking at their skulls that Africans are inferior, or that you can tell because the distance between their navel and their penis is smaller than it is for white people, so said the scientists, that they were made for forced labor. I mean, so that was another rationale. Another rationale was philanthropic, because what we're doing is we're civilizing them. We're raising these people out of their sloth, and we're teaching them how to work. And these were all the arguments put forth, and we can all.
And it still goes on.
Oh yeah, it absolutely still goes on. And that's another thing is that, you know, we can all just say that, you know, these people were stupid bigots, but But think about it for a second. What if somebody said to you, or said to any of us, you know what, you own this piece of land, or you think you own this piece of land, but the land never gave you permission to cut down the trees on it, or to run a bulldozer over it. Did you ask permission? Does the land, is this what the land wants? And of course, if you said that to somebody, they would look at you like you're crazy, because they would say, you know, the land can't think. It's like, ah, that's it. 150 years ago, that's exactly what slaveholders would have said. Mm-hmm. Now, these black people can't think. They're like children. They need our help. And it's the same, it's the exact same thing. It's just that that's another thing I'll get to in a second, is that at least these days, for the most part, we think that black people can think, but we haven't extended that to, we still enslave the world. And there's another thing that's pretty interesting. There's this guy said, I always thought that slavery stopped because of the Civil War. That's what I was taught in school. But I really realized, and all of my African-American friends, when I told them that I'd realized this, they started laughing at me and said, you know, it took you long enough. But I realized that that's not actually why slavery stopped. The reason that slavery stopped is because there are land ownership conditions in which it is in the best interest of the capitalists to own people, and there are land ownership conditions in which it is in the best interest of the capitalists not to own people. Oh, and by the way, there are more slaves in the world today than there were came over on the Middle Passage. We can talk about that in a minute if you want.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is. But the thing about the land ownership is very interesting, that if you have a lot of land and not very many people on it, since land makes self-sufficiency, I mean, that's the only way to be self-sufficient, is to have access to land, and because land provides everything.
Sure.
So if there's a lot of land and not many people, the only way you can get them to work for you is at gunpoint, by owning them. And if, on the other hand, there are a lot of people and not much land, they have to work for you, because otherwise they're going to starve to death. They can't feed themselves. So when you get a large concentration of people with not much land, as happened in the cities in the north, then it was manifestly in the best interest of those of the owners of capital to not own the slaves, because if you own the slaves, who are quite expensive, they cost about $50,000 to $80,000, the equivalent of a small house, and the return on investment was only about 5% per year. They had to take care of them, they had to feed them when they're young, when they're old, they had to take care of them when they're sick, which didn't happen with the capitalists. If they get sick, they're out the door.
This is like talking about cattle.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so what the book is about is really about these forms. It started off to be about looking at, I was going to, like I said, just do this introduction to hate groups, but then it ended up very quickly sort of exploding into these larger atrocities. That why is it that some guy gets dragged behind a pickup in Texas and we're horrified, rightfully so, but, you know, murders on a much larger scale are routinely ignored. And a couple of riddles that I tell in the book, which aren't very funny, are the first one is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. Second riddle is, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and 8,000 dead? Answer, retirement with full benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide of Bhopal. And so, you know, it's crazy. We think, oh my gosh, we got to lock up murderers, because there's, you know, they've got to make the streets safe. Well, there's about 16,000 murders committed every year in the United States, and there are that many people die of preventable cancer every 2 weeks. And so if we really wanted to get serious, we'd lock up those, those bad guys who run the chemical companies and run the tobacco companies. And, or there are 40,000 people, I think it's 40,000, I've got the number in the book, I don't remember what it is right now, 40,000 people die a year in automobile accidents. But we simply accept those deaths as as part of getting along. But I mean, that's a pretty interesting, you know, if we want to make the streets safe, we get rid of cars.
And that will bring us to our first break already, Derek. This is a fascinating thing. I can see why you ended up with a lot of pages on this. This is really, really interesting.
Well, thanks.
And anyway, we're going to break. This is Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Nancy and Elena. Our guest is Derek Jensen, author of A Language Older Than Words, and his latest book just out called The Culture of Make-Believe. Fascinating stuff. We'll be right back at right after this. We asked Amazon John Easterling how using the Amazon Herb Company Rainforest Herbs supports the indigenous people and the future of the rainforest.
Well, every time we consume a bottle of herbs, you know, that creates the demand, the replacement bottle of herbs. So in a nutshell, you know, we're making the rainforest more valuable being alive than being dead. The lumber people have been thrown out because the indigenous communities are just we're able to get the rights to the land now, the deeds to the land. So we're affecting now about 16 different communities in the Amazon. So we anticipate this to continue to grow, and our ultimate objective is, of course, to really make a very positive impact on the entire Amazon basin.
For more information, call 800-551-2933. That's 800-551-2933.
And on the web at amazon-life.com.
Again, his website is Derek Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, .org, and contextbooks.com is his publisher, and you can also find a lot of information about the books there. One thing, if you send an email to Derek, I think he may still have some books that he can sell you direct, and they will be autographed, so that is very cool thing. You still have them, don't you, Derek?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay. Before we get back to you, I want to talk about this thing, and it is appropriate right now to do so. On the weekend of
April 27th,
there will be, beginning in Watsonville, a reenactment of the internment of the Japanese Americans during World War II. That's 60 years ago when President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. That is, it's the tickets are free, but they are required. We are going to have Mas Hashimoto on to talk about this, and you can call 831-722-6859. Also go to Liberty Lost Tickets at yahoo.com, write for tickets. And on our website, there's a link from the front page. You can read about it. This is important to remember these things, and it is important to have people like Derek that helps us to understand what is going on and not forget.
And, of course, our website is eaglecondor.net.
So, Derek, there are a couple of questions, and take them in whatever point of the talk that you want. But one is about what is the difference or the similarity between the government and hate groups. And the other one, which I found interesting in the preamble you sent me, is when you ask the FBI for a definition of civil rights, that is a chilling little conversation in its insanity. So at any point that you can talk about those two things?
Well, the one where I called and asked about why is raping a woman not a hate crime? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Keep your volume up if you can.
I'm sorry?
Keep as loud as you can so we avoid that feedback devil.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
Thanks, Derek.
It ends up that if a man rapes a woman because she is African American or because she is lesbian or because she is dating an Asian man or whatever, that can be a hate crime under the law. But it ends up that if he rapes her because she's a woman, then that can't be called a hate crime. And so I called the FBI to ask about that explicitly, and was very clear that. I'll see if I can.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, I'll find it in the book real fast.
I've got it right here.
Okay, wait, I got it. Okay, I took it up with the FBI. I was talking to a spokeswoman. She said the reason rape isn't included is that the motivation is obviously different. The motivation is not to violate their civil rights, but from a desire to hurt or from a desire to just have sex. I mean, I couldn't believe that even today people are still saying this. Anyway, I asked for the FBI's definition of civil rights. She looked it up and said, the rights belonging to a person by virtue of his or her status as a citizen or as a member of civil society. So I asked for the FBI's definition of a hate crime. And she said, a hate crime is a criminal offense committed against person, property, or society, which is motivated in whole or part by the offender's bias against a race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, or ethnicity. One more definition, rape. The carnal knowledge of a female forcibly and against her will. And which definition, by the way, doesn't include males. It's very interesting. So I said, let me get this straight. A woman's or any person's civil rights do not include freedom from unwanted carnal knowledge. And she essentially agreed. Which really gets back to, I think, one of the central things, one of the things I was really interested in language, and one of the things I'm really interested in here, and I'm always really interested in, is perception. And how it is that we, once again, can see certain forms of violence, and there are other forms of violence that we cannot see, and how do we become enculturated to not see those? And the central metaphor of this book is the story from the Bible of Ham and Noah. Do you know that story?
No.
It's a really interesting story. Okay, Noah, you know, was the guy who with the ark and everything. And he had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And one time Noah got drunk and passed out. And Ham went in and saw him passed out. And he came back out and he told his brothers. And his brothers walked in backwards so they wouldn't see their father. And they covered him up and then walked back out without ever looking at him. And then when Noah woke up, he learned that Ham had seen him naked and then talked about it, and because of that, he enslaved Ham and his descendants forever to Shem and Japheth. And that was historically, biblically, that was oftentimes given as one of the reasons for the enslavement of black people, that they were supposedly the sons and daughters of Ham. And when I read this as a kid, or when I learned this as a kid, I didn't understand it. It's like, what did Ham do that was so terrible? But starting this book, that image just kept coming to mind until finally I realized that it's really sort of the central image of how an oppressive system works. And the reason is because Ham had violated the fundamental rule of this. I'm looking for it in the book right here. That in order to maintain a system of oppression, you have to have rigid protocols. And the first and most important of those is that you must never see those in power naked, which means as they are and vulnerable, in this case passed out. Because if you see those in power as as they are, if you see them for what they're what they really are about, and if you see if they really are vulnerable, then they've lost their ability to enslave you through any means other than force. Once again, if you see those in power as they are, they lose their power over you. And so that's why that becomes a central metaphor of the book.
That's right, because then we realize that we're all the same, or at least we're all equal in that. But the paradigm is that people are, you know, better than us or whatever.
Yep.
In the rationale then.
Yeah, we realize that the only reason that they are rulers and we are not is social convention.
Mm-hmm.
We realize that the reason that some people are enslaved and some people are not is because of social convention and physical force. It's not because of, you know, divine right. It's not because of anything else.
And we're buying into that because of our cultural conditioning.
Right. Well, we're buying into that because of our cultural conditioning, and also it depends on who we are. That we, and certainly including myself, you know, sort of middle class Americans, another reason we buy into it is because we are rewarded very well for buying into it.
Right.
You know, I kind of like watching baseball games on my mom's TV, and I kind of like listening to CDs. You know, I kind of like using my computer that was manufactured in Thailand and gave the women cancer who manufactured it. You know, the whole economy is that's one of the things that I do talk about too, is that there are I break the culture into sort of four groups, and there are the leaders who believe that they rule by divine right. I mean, this is as true today as it was back in the time of the kings. And, you know, I've got lots of quotes that back that up. And then that's the first group that really believe that they can do whatever they want. And then there's the second group, which is the majority of us in the United States, at least, who buy into this dream. And we're kept in line by psychology in great measure, by carrots of, you know, raises and stuff, and also by the very real fear of what will happen to us if we step out of line. And then there's the third group, which is those who resist or those who may resist, and those people have to be taken out in a spectacular fashion. And that's a good reason why there are so many poor people and so many people of color in prison, is because they need to be stopped before they can actually get politicized. Many of my students at the prison are among the most politically astute people I've ever met. I mean, they know what's going on. And the fourth group of people are those who are simply extra and who need to be killed or who need to be just removed from the land. And that would be the Indians. That would be the Palestinians. That would be, you know, anybody who's on land that is wanted by those in power. That would have been in Nazi Germany, that would have been the Slavs, that would have been the Jews, except they didn't have land, they had other wealth. But people who simply need to be eliminated. And that's from the perspective of those in power. And that's another thing I talk about extensively in the last half of the book. Another thing I want to mention, and then I'll get back to the other question, is that as I was studying all this stuff about the slavery, I kept wondering, you know, where does hate fit into this? And then, you know, there weren't a lot of lynchings prior to the American Civil War. And the lynchings that did occur, it was not primarily a racial thing. It was rough justice. It'd be if your neighbor steals a bunch of stuff from you, you say, don't do that. And if they do it again, then a bunch of your friends get together and lynch them or something. It was not a specific tool of oppression. But then after the Civil War, there were just, you know, we will never know how many African Americans were killed in the tens of thousands, and at least, and so how did that happen? What was the deal? I was thinking for several days, where does hate fit into slavery? And finally it occurred to me when I read this quote by Nietzsche, one does not hate when one can despise. And then everything fell into place for me, that so long as your religion or science or legal traditions or whatever are sufficient to maintain that sense of entitlement by the rich, then there's no reason for them to hate those that they're exploiting. It's only when those they're exploiting actually begin to fight back, or when that entitlement is threatened, then that contempt turns over into outright hatred. And you can see this on a personal level. I mean, we've talked before from my book Language about my father being very violent. Well, his violence was bad enough, but the one time that my brother resisted and fought back, he got beaten far worse than ever. And, you know, one of the fundamental rules of our culture is that violence only flows one direction. And that sort of violence is expected. It's allowable. It's just the way things are. And when violence flows the other direction, that's blasphemy. It's looked upon as the victims are fetishized. And a really good example of that is, you know, whenever a policeman dies in the line of duty, there's, you know, these huge state funerals. It's a huge deal when somebody is a cop killer. And of course, A, police in this country, there are 4 to 6 Americans die every day as a result of having encountered police. That's through high-speed chases, it's through shootings, it's through medical neglect. And some of these are, you know, people who are, you know, blasting way back at the cops. But a lot of them are simply innocent bystanders or people who, I mean, I've got that in the book, just tons of examples of, you know, sort of the Amadou Diallo, the cases that we hear about are not rare. But the point is that do you know what the most dangerous civil service job is?
What?
It's not a cop, it's not a firefighter, it's a garbage collector. Garbage collectors have a far higher rate of mortality than cops or firefighters or any of them because they're working next to this moving vehicle. They get hit all the time.
Wow.
And, you know, but when a garbage collector dies, do we have a big state funeral? No, the victim is not fetishized. And the reason the cops are fetishized when they die is because they're allowed to give violence but not allowed to receive it. And so let's go back to your other question. Your other question was what's the difference between a nation state and a hate group?
Right. And Derek, excuse me, we'll come back to that one right
okay.
after the break.
Okay.
This is Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Nancy and Elena, and you're listening to Derek Jensen, author of the newest book, The Culture of Make-Believe. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Give your body the life, energy, nutrition you need with the Rainforest Health Packs, the fastest, easiest, and most cost-effective way to experience the power of the Amazon herbs is to start with a Rainforest Health Pack.
It was carefully designed to give you the essential nutrients your body needs to feel the benefits of vibrant health and vitality. Experience for yourself the richest concentration of healing life energy on the planet.
The Health Pack includes Illumination, a complete formula for whole body health. Sumacasan for youthful energy and vitality. Aquazon, increase energy and strengthen the immune system. Fibrozon to maintain a healthy intestinal tract. A free bottle of stevia, a natural herb 300 times sweeter than sugar. And of course, the delicious Shipibo Treasure Tea, plus an additional free product of your choice.
For more information, call 800-551-2933. That's 800-551-2933.
Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Nancy and Elena, and our guest this hour is Derek Jensen, author of A Language Older Than Words and his latest book, The Culture of Make-Believe. He has many other books as well, and you can find information about him on our website, which is eaglecondor.net, or you're welcome to go directly to Derek's website, which is www.derekjensen.org, and that is DerrickJensen.org. You can send email to him from there. So, Derek, we're back to you now. The second question you're going to address.
The difference between hate groups and nation states?
Yes.
Well, as you've come to expect, I'm going to address that by going around in a circle.
You know, you do this beautifully. I want to mention this before we run out of
uh-huh.
time today, that the way you break things down and put them back together again really gives us another whole dimension of thinking about things. And it's really awesome because it's like, well, duh, that's obvious. Why had I ever noticed that before? And I see, as you point these things out, we're learning how our rationale is working in our mind. And I just think it's a wonderful perceptions that you are sharing with everyone.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Really, I'm not against hate. You know, and we talk about it, but hate is just another emotion. I mean, it always just kind of bugs me when people say, you know, don't be angry, don't be fearful, don't be, you know, don't have hate. And those are simply emotions. They're not, I don't think they're good or bad. And my problem really is with abstraction or objectification. I think that somebody can hate someone. I think it's perfectly reasonable to hate someone because of who that person is, because of what that person may have done to you or whatever. I don't have a problem with that. But I have a problem. I mean, if you hate someone who happens to be an African-American female because she did something really, really bad to you, that's one thing. But if you hate her because she's an African-American female, you're hating a stereotype. You're not even giving her the honor of hating her as a person, as this individual person, or, you know, whatever. That's just one example, obviously. And so really, what I'm much more interested in than hate, in a sense, is objectification and the turning of others into objects. And this happens this is one of the things that hate groups do, is that, you know, those bad people of other races, they're, you know, it's not this person, this person, this person. It's they are bad because of their physical characteristics. And then, but all they're doing is they're manifesting something that's really central to our whole culture, which is turning everything into objects. And that's what, for example, corporations do. That's what our whole process of production is. What is production? Production is the turning of the living into the dead. It's turning of a living forest into 2x4s. It's the conversion of individual human beings into a labor force. It's all about objectification. And actually, I'm not against objectification as such either, because you can't. Martin Buber has this great book, I and Thou, about how it is to. And he says there's two types of relationships. I-you, which is where I perceive you as another individual, and I-it, where I perceive you as an object to be exploited, and or to be experienced, as the case may be. And one of the things that Buber makes clear, and this is true for many of us, is that you can't go through your life perceiving everyone as a you at all moments, or you sort of existentially seize up. You know, if I walk down a city street to think that every single person is alive, and to consider the uniqueness of each person, I mean, you sort of go into a meltdown immediately. You can't interact that way. But the problem is when we forget the difference, when we forget that we are objectifying, when we forget that actual individuals are being objectified. It's not a big deal to walk down the street and to sort of close off to a lot of the people. You simply have to. And that's just people. I mean, what if you're considering that every ant that you see has a life that's just as precious to it as yours is to you. And that's a really important realization to have. But one can't walk through one's day without it every moment, or one burns up, as Buber says. But once again, the problem is when we've gotten so used to objectifying that we forget the difference. And so we treat the world as if it were dead. We treat all these black people as if they are actually cargo to be shipped over in boats to be turned into slaves. Well, they've already been turned into slaves. So there's a double process has to happen. First, you have to convert this other into an object in your mind, and then you do it in the real world. There's a great line by this Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And that's it. You know, and when white people looked at the Indians, They saw people who were on land that they really wanted, people who needed to be gotten. No, they didn't see people. They saw savages who not needed to be gotten rid of. When they looked at Africans, they saw field hands. And nowadays, you know, we simply don't see that others exist. And so where does that tie back to nation states? Well, first off, there's a real, you know, we think, well, a nation state can't be a hate group because, you know, hate groups are in opposition. But that leads us to an absurdity, because what that would mean is that the American Nazi Party, with its, you know, paltry membership, would be a hate group, but Nazi Germany would not have been. You know, the Soviet Union was pretty hateful. And, you know, frankly, the United States has killed a lot more people than Nazi Germany ever did, a lot more innocent people than Nazi Germany ever did. And so nation states, one of the things I hit at the end of the book that I'm pretty excited about, and I get a lot of this analysis from Zygmunt Bauman's great book, Modernity and the Holocaust, in which he talks about how a bureaucracy is actually much more efficient at committing atrocities than a group of angry people, because it's much more reliable. And you don't have to rely on something so fickle as passion. You simply set up rules that allow you to objectify. I mean, these days, those people who, you know, the American soldiers who are killing Afghans, they're pushing buttons. You know, they're not actually killing people in their own experience. They've already distanced themselves so far from the act of killing that it's become an entirely abstract action. You know, if I had to kill someone, you know, with my bare hands, I would have to feel their life leave. And if I stabbed them, I'd get blood all over my hands. Even if I shot them, I'd still have to see the bullet hit them. But, you know, we can get so far distant that someone can, you know, as I say, you can commit genocide from the comfort of your living room. And Raoul Hilberg, who's probably the preeminent historian of the Holocaust, said that the thing that has to be remembered is that most of the people who were killing the Jews were not actually, you know, shooting them. They weren't forcing them into gas chambers. Most of them were sitting at typewriters. Simply, I'll see if I can find the quote. It's a really great quote. That.
So it sounds like we're all in a little bit of a touch of sociopathic, in that we. This is what you're describing as in our society is where the separateness we feel comes from, I think, then. Because we are considering everyone else as objects and distant, not connected to us.
Right.
Which in reality we all are, but we don't go across the street and see our neighbor and meet them because of this, you know, kind of sociopathic mentality you're describing here.
That's really true. And our whole system is set up to fragment us that way. I mean, I mentioned earlier this thing about buying a computer. Well, it's manifestly in my best interest as a consumer to purchase the cheapest computer, and or to purchase a computer at all, you know, whatever. But as a citizen, a lot of those decisions that I make are frankly appalling, because all of those things carry with them the taint of exploitation. I mean, chocolate, for example. I don't remember if it's a third or two thirds. It's one or the other of the chocolate in the world today is tainted with slave labor. If you have steel from Brazil, it's tainted with slave labor from the charcoal industry down there. It's the entire global economy is as we know. I mean, A, it's killing the planet, and B, it's immiserating people all over the world, and yet we're put in a position daily to make these decisions. I mean, after we get off here, I'm going to go drive to the prison where I'm going to teach. That's great. Yeah, I'm doing a great thing by teaching. It's also, you know, driving. It's much more convenient than for me to walk the however many miles. But, you know, that global warming, you know, the whole mining industry, the whole industrial economic system is destructive from top to bottom. And that's one of the things that needs to be gotten rid of, which is a whole other topic we can talk about. Do you have another? I guess I'm just rambling. If you have anything else to ask or anything, that's great.
No, we like to hear you ramble.
Oh, thank you.
We have about 2 minutes, and I'll just read the quote for today, and then we can continue talking. In the end, more than freedom, they wanted security. They wanted a comfortable life, and they lost it all. Security, comfort, and freedom. When the Athenians finally wanted not to give to society, but for society to give to them, when the freedom they wished for most was freedom from responsibility, then Athens ceased to be free and was never free again. I think that's fitting to where we are.
Yeah, that's great.
When you were mentioning that the objectification of people, this is becoming worse because we're not given a choice anymore to buy products that are built here. Objectification comes because the companies just see a cheap place to build and manufacture, not the people that are going to do it. So we've got 1 minute.
Well, that's actually a really interesting thing, too, because I did a lot I talked both about the Chinese experience in America and the Irish experience in America, and the capitalists were doing the exact same thing with, you know, nowadays they threaten to move factories overseas, and what they were threatening to do back in the 19th century is they were threatening to bring in workers from out of the country. And so they've been doing this exact same thing to drive wages down for forever. It's just nowadays it's cheaper to move the factory than it is to bring the people.
Well, for our listeners, go out and get that book as soon as it's available, and you can reach Paul through our website at Pilgrim's Way, and he can order it. And then when Derek comes back, having a trouble talking today, we will begin again. Derek, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. You're both, I want to say this publicly, you're both such wonderful interviewers.
Thank you
very much. And thank you again for giving us such food for thought, because it just makes us think a lot after any of these interviews with you as well.
And the books,
yes. This has been Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Nancy and Elaine, and again our guest is Derek Jensen, author of his latest book, The Culture of Make-Believe. And you can get to his website, derekjensen.org.
Don't you love those titles, too?
They're great. We thank you all for listening over the airwaves, and we thank you all for listening over the internet waves, because the world can listen now. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye, Derek.
Bye.